Hello there, it's Tabitha Brown. Let me tell you about YouTube Premium. I can watch my favorite videos without ads interrupting me. And honey, when I'm cooking, I don't need no interruptions. The onions need me. My garlic needs me. Plus, I can download videos for when I don't have Wi-Fi and keep listening with background play. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at YouTube.com/premium. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Trial eligibility varies, terms apply, and cancel anytime.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1422.JO0502, certificate number 43923, West Edmonton Mall. Find yourself at West Edmonton Mall. Adam, hello. Welcome to the Omnibus Project.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're a person who is doing a show about a place that you are pretty close to geographically. How far are you sitting right now in your space pod? How far are you from the West Edmonton Mall of your show?
In my space pod, we measure distance with time. And so I am about 13 minutes drive from my space pod from the mall. So I'm very close.
13 minutes drive. And is it a place when you were growing up that you went and got your school supplies? And
oh, yes. We did all of the things at the mall. It was prominent feature in my life, having grown up not much farther than I am now.
And speaking as someone in Edmonton, did you, as we did in Alaska, spend a lot of winter time just at the mall, in the mall, in order to be not in the house?
Yes. And this mall is a special mall. And it's not just any other mall. You know, it had a movie theater, had a food court, typical of other malls. But to your point, when you wanted to get out in the winter, you wanted to be somewhere warm, you could go to a water park at this mall, which would have simulated waves, you know, water slides, lazy river, fights at the concession stand, all the things.
There is no such place in Alaska, and that makes me so mad. Why? Why did they not build a water park in one of the big dumb malls? There was, I swear to you, I'm not kidding, the Diamond Center had an ice skating rink in it, which is like they had to make the ice rink cold, surrounded by a mall that is fending off the cold. Why would you not go the extra mile? You've already heated the mall. Why not just heat it more and put in a water slide? Oh my God.
Well, this mall also had a skating rink, a full size NHL rink. And so if you wanted to go even skating, because there weren't enough skating rinks, that there needed one more. So they put one in the mall.
Well, and this is I guess, a function of Edmonton being six times larger than Anchorage, which, in the American imagination, Edmonton, I have to say, does not feature prominently.
I expect not.
But in the Canadian, I think an Anchorage probably gets at least as, I mean, would ring a bell with at least as many Americans as would have heard of Edmonton, and it's six times smaller. In the Canadian imagination, does Edmonton, like, does it play, what role does it play in Canada's sense of self? Like, we have Dallas, we have Denver, we have Chicago. They all play like some individual, distinct role in what we think of as America. Like, what does Edmonton do?
Well, Edmonton famously is known as a good place to be from. That this is there's a writer from Montreal. I won't say his name because I won't, you know, encourage people to read him because he denigrates the city. That's my job today. and so, no, Edmonton's a good place to be from, but also a great place to move to. It's a great place to come and, you know, make money and then leave back to wherever you're from or where you'd rather stay instead. It's kind of got a, you need a really good reason to want to be here. Cause as the climate goes, it's not that nice. It's not that hospitable. You're not that close to, you know, if you want to get somewhere warm, you're far away from getting somewhere warm, being in Edmonton. So you have to have a reason to be here. And that I think is kind of what people know Edmonton of in the Canadian imagination is why Edmonton? There's so many other places. But Edmonton's a great place and it's a great place. I choose to be here. I could have moved anywhere in this fair country at any point, when I was a young man and didn't have any deep roots here. And, I choose to keep my roots here because it's a good place. But, in terms of what people think of it, probably not that much. And that's why I was excited to talk about it on Omnibus. Cause I think Edmonton is a bit of an oddity on its own, but the mall itself is probably the oddest thing about Edmonton.
But Edmonton and Calgary, although yeah. Albertan, siblings, Calgary and Edmonton are more or less the same size. It's not like one, it's not like Calgary is massively bigger than Edmonton. But Calgary has a much higher opinion of itself.
Sure. It's hosted the Olympics. John Candy made a movie that was based in Calgary.
Right. The right. Olympics.
Cool Runnings. They have the Stampede, so they claim to be the largest outdoor show on earth, and it's been going on for probably a century or so, and it's a rodeo of some size, and it's a pretty big deal, yeah.
Is the Stampede safe?
For who?
Well, we have something called the OMAC Stampede here in Washington, where they go off a cliff, like a bunch of riders on horseback basically just go off a cliff, and it's not like a steep hill. It's really a cliff, but it's just shallow enough of an angle that horses can kind of tumble down it. And if you're a very excellent rider and your horse is very sure-footed, you can kind of stay upright. And that's the point of the event. And in ye olden times, it must have seemed like great fun to watch like all these horses die. I mean, I don't know how many horses die at the OMAC Stampede, but nowadays it seems very anachronistic.
That sounds quite horrific. And even by my standards, as somebody who's like okay with the rodeo, like I don't feel too yucky about it. I understand why you might. But no, the Calgary Stampede sounds safer and more civilized than that, if a rodeo can be such a thing. Yeah, you'd have to have some effort and intention to go there. Like, it's busy and be a pain in the neck to get around town when it's happening. So it wouldn't be like just something you'd say like on a whim, do you want to go check out the Stampede? It's like a one night a year or one weekend a year kind of a event, right?
Yeah. I tried to go to the Olympics in Calgary when they were there, and I got as far as getting into a car full of people, and we got up to North Idaho, and I don't know, somebody forgot their driver's license, or we all went into a bar to have some beer and tomato juice, and then we never made it all the way to Calgary. It didn't. I regret
it. Like a ski bum sort of scenario, like
yeah. It felt, and you know, some of the people that were on my recent heli-skiing trip into Alberta were also in the car when we tried to go to Calgary back in the 1980s. Same people, same place.
But did you make it this time?
We did make it to the heli-skiing, yeah.
And how was that for you?
Well, honestly, at the time, I felt like our guides took us to like some dumb places. Like, what are we doing? Like, we're heli-skiing. We should be up in the high, soft snow. What are we doing down here in this river bottom? You know, like
Easter,
dodging trees. And then With time, I've realized that the real problem was that I was too fat and had not prepared adequately for the tremendous physical effort of doing multiple runs down huge mountains in untracked snow. It's very demanding. And when I was 25, which is what I still think I am, I could do this all day. You could shoot me out of a cannon and I would climb back up and shoot me out of a cannon again. But what I really was completely exhausted. And that was the problem.
A really well-rounded take on it, that you're the problem.
I was the problem.
Yeah.
It took me a few months to understand that I was the problem, but
yeah,
it's too bad. I'm in better shape now, but I still don't feel like I'm in good enough shape to go heli-skiing for 2 days. I would need to start now in order to do it in January. Like just waking up every morning and doing 200 squats.
Just get into form.
Are you a skier?
Am I a skier? In Edmonton, it's quite flat out here. And so our skiing is in the river valley, which is pretty modest. And so most people do what you describe is just enough to sort of get into shape to go to the mountains. And then, so again, you need a reason to be in town because there's better things to do elsewhere.
Now, you told me at the beginning of our conversation that you are an urban planner. Are you an urban planner that is employed by the public in the public good, or are you a private? Did you hang out an urban planning shingle?
All planners, they call themselves registered professional planners. That's what I ascribe to as a professional. So it's a regulated profession. They all represent the public interest in their work. And so you most often will work for the private sector, whether that's a municipal government or provincial government or county or some sort of agency. But lots of people in planning work as a private sector consultants for developers. And through that work, they are still meant to be good professionals and represent the public interest through that. And so that's a big part of what being a planner is that you don't represent necessarily your employer's interest. You represent the interest of the whole.
And your employer, then there's a lot of tension between, or there would be some tension between the employer who is trying to get you to sign off on things that they want to get signed off so that they can get done. And you are saying this is going to be slightly harder than that to do properly. And what kind of authority do you have in the process?
Sure. So some planners will have like specific authority. They'll like have a job that says, my job is to make sure that, you know, all the permits that come through this office comply with the rules. And I have a stamp. And so that gives me special authority. I might be called a development officer, a planning officer, something like that. Some planners write policy and their authority is sort of, it's big, but it takes a long time for it to be felt because it's, you know, setting the rules for things that don't happen very often or rules or setting out land use for things that might not change for a long time, right? And so you might not appreciate, oh, that land set aside, like Central Park wasn't always surrounded by towering buildings. At one point, it was countryside, right? And you come to appreciate the power of planning, of setting aside a piece of land like that to achieve something over time. So the tension is always there to, you know, get things done, cut red tape, enable development because you want to support the economy. You want to make sure people are working, jobs are going. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, there's processes and rules in place that are meant to be followed to protect the public interest. And you do that by minimizing impact, John. So negative impact of development, there's lots of them. Probably the most contentious one these days is data centers. People are quite upset about the impact of data centers. So that's a planning topic. And like, I kind of think of it as like a catcher in the rye. Like I'm out there making sure nothing too bad happens to all those people. I think nobody's running off the cliff on my watch. Make sure that the right thing happens in the right way and you follow the virtuous process. That's the idea of planning. And if you follow that virtuous process, you make sure the right people have a voice at the table and not just the people with the money and the power, right?
When you think about Western cities in North America versus Eastern cities, a lot of the Western cities had the opportunity for planning in a kind of nascent way because they were building a city just out of prairie. There wasn't anything there before. They didn't have to deal with narrow little streets or a built environment. They could just say, like in Spokane, they laid out the streets so that you could turn a horse and wagon around mid-block, like just in neighborhoods. The streets are, you could drive 10 cars abreast down just a neighborhood street because they were like, why not? We have all the space in the world. Do you feel like Edmonton is well planned?
Edmonton is planned, certainly, in areas of it are well planned. On the whole, I think it's a nice place to live. I choose to live here for a reason. So I think that speaks for itself. Is it exactly how I'd want it? No. It's probably good it's not exactly how I'd want it, though, because that'd just be my city for me. And that's the kind of thing with cities, is that you kind of like, I think a lot of urban planners, at least myself, grew up maybe playing a game like SimCity, and you have like, oh, well, design cities. And like, I know how to do it, of course. I'm smart. I've got the best taste in buildings and stuff. And then you go to university and you learn that's not really what it is. And you decide if you want to keep doing it once you found out what it actually is. And if you're interested in participating in that process, which is a big collaborative process of building cities over time, it's a really cool process and project that we're all part of, right? Settlement goes back, I don't know, 15,000 years. And I feel fortunate to participate in that as a profession. Yeah. I think it's such a fascinating field to work in because it requires so many different aspects of knowledge and understanding. And you get to work with so many different kinds of experts too, right? Like you get to work with people who are experts in the environment. And that means a lot of different things, like people that are experts in like the ecology of wetlands, people that are experts in agronomy, people who are, tree experts, and then you have electrical engineers and architects, and then social planners, and then recreation. There's this whole world of sports, and like you want to talk about city planning and sports, like just soccer fields and the drama around that as a land use topic, or pickleball for as another example. There's this whole category of recreation and land use in that world. How could you possibly know everything that goes on in a city? It's an endless problem, right? Like you can go down to the rats crawling around in the alleys, the gum stuck on the shoe. There's no limit to what you could look at and understand. And that's the great joy of traveling too, I think, is to go to other cities and learn about how they feel and different flavors. And Edmonton, at West Edmonton Mall, you could go to the mall and you could travel and see other cities there. And they had flavors of Bourbon Street, of Europa Boulevard, and you could experience what that was meant to feel like. And that was an intentional piece of that project. But I kind of maybe jumped the gun here, talked about our topic.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that the topic of your show, the West Edmonton Mall, is a kind of Epcot center of culture?
Yes. It's a great postmodern institution. And it's one that sometimes gets made fun of, gets ridiculed, perhaps rightly from an architectural perspective, but it's had significant impact in my life and on this community, and has had impact outside of Edmonton because the model that was cultivated here has been used again and again. It resulted in billions and billions of dollars of investment in places across North America and Middle East and elsewhere.
Is this one of those things where in the United States, almost nobody probably outside of Minot, North Dakota, has ever heard of the West Edmonton Mall, but everyone in Canada knows about it, and it has some kind of legendary status?
Yeah, definitely. Like if you met somebody, say in like the 90s or early 2000s, and you told them you were from Edmonton, you say you were traveling, say, oh, the mall, right? That's kind of the thing they would know about it. Or Gretzky, they're the Oilers. Rescue okay. The Oilers or the mall. Yeah.
Really? I would really like to do something about my aging. And I'm not prepared to use any kind of serums or even to moisturize. It just never occurs to me. And I'm many, many moons psychologically away from ever having any kind of surgery. Honestly, I believe that if I could just keep my hair, in fact, just keep it as it is, that would go miles toward my confidence as I continue to age into my looks and beauty. And one of the things that keeps me from beginning a hair retention process, it's exhausting to go out looking and weeding through all of the literature and all of the conflicting advice about hair loss treatments. And I know that catching dealing with your hair loss early makes a huge difference. The sooner you start dealing with it, the greater your options. And that's why I'm so intrigued by longtime Omnibus Project supporter, Hims. Hims has a simple, 100% online process, and they offer personalized treatment plans that are delivered straight to you. Hims is transparent, it's straightforward, it's designed to make getting this kind of hair treatment care feel easy. And you get the choices of getting sort of the right hair regrowth treatment, flexible subscription options, 24/7 provider support. So somebody like me, whose balding is nascent, I'm certainly losing my hair, but you know, I'm on the threshold of it having an impact on particularly photographs of my band taken from behind. So I want to encourage anyone in my position or who's been experiencing hair loss for a long time, who's interested in regrowing or maintaining their hair, to go to hims.com/omnibus and get a free online consultation. Hims also offers personalized and affordable care for hair loss, for ED, for weight loss. And it's sort of a one-stop shop. Go to hims.com/omnibus for a free online consultation and find out what Hims can do for you. Now, some of their featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription is required. Individual results may vary. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. That's hims.com/omnibus. Well, so what's the backstory of this mall? Break it down for me. Yeah, break it down for us here on the omnibus.
Well, let me ask you a question about carpets. What do you know about the carpet importing business, Joe? The reason I bring it up is because the people who developed this fabulous mall, West Edmonton Mall, got their start as carpet merchants, as Persian carpet dealers. And, you know, my limited experience buying carpets is trying to get a good one for cheap. And I don't really know what a good one means. Exactly. So I think just natural fiber, maybe. And you go shopping and you can see these carpets. They're like tens of thousands of dollars, some of them. Yeah. And it's like, I'm certainly not at a place in my life where I buy carpets like that, but maybe someone is, or maybe not. Maybe that's just the starting price and people are paying like a tenth of that. I've never haggled on a really expensive Persian carpet, but some family in the 50s and 60s and 70s made a bucket of money selling Persian carpets in North America. And they did this pre-Islamic revolution. So I imagine there is healthy trade from Persia to North America through the ports of Montreal and New York. And this is a family called the Gurmesians, and they're a famous family in Edmonton, and somewhat famous family for other reasons. They were extremely wealthy family in Iran, Persia, prior to moving to North America. And in fact, it is claimed hosted meetings for the Tehran conference. Really? Between the likes of Stalin and Churchill and others. So at some point, this family emigrated. I don't know if all of them did, but certainly enough of them did, to North America and found their way to the frigid north of Canada, in Alberta, and decided they would buy a lot of land around here. And probably the reason they were looking to do this was there was a lot of oil that had been found in this part of the world.
So they were savvy.
Yes. And so they said, we're going to take our money from carpets and we're going to turn that into something else. We're going to turn that hopefully into oil, but at very least we'll turn it into a bunch of land holdings in a fast growing place. And so eventually that those land holdings accumulated in such a way that they were able to transact with the provincial government. So we don't have states in Canada, we have provinces. The province of Alberta takes a long time to plan a ring road, John. So if you want to build a highway or a freeway around a fast growing city, you might start thinking about in the 70s. People might not drive until that, you know, till 2003, right? Uh-huh. And so it's a scenario like this, where there's a big ring road planned for around Edmonton, which at the time is a metropolis of maybe 500, 600,000 people, envisioning a time when it might have 1.5 million people like we have today, right? So this big ring road basically went around the whole city, and a big portion of the West End was owned by the Gurmesians. And so while they did not find oil in this land, they did find great fortune, because there's two ways you can make a lot of money in Alberta. And one of them is through oil and gas, and the other is through having privileged access to the government and through getting cutting edge access to some kind of land deal, some kind of deregulation, some kind of contract. And, you know, our political history is littered with stories like this.
And in the provinces, do you have mineral rights and like resource rights that are separate from ownership of the land?
They're separate, but you can acquire them both, right? If you know what you're doing. Yeah.
And so,
certainly, if you own, even if you own the land, if somebody wants to enjoy those mineral rights, they might have to pay you for the privilege of getting onto your land, right? Just because they could pull the rocks out of the dirt doesn't mean that they can drive a truck on it and do that without asking, right?
And so your family, and I'm sorry, what was the family called?
Gurmesians.
The Gurmesians didn't find wealth in the minerals on the land, but they did find wealth in controlling the land and the access that the land gated.
The land was at some point identified as the preferred alignment for this ring road. And savvy people saw this coming, saw that, hey, they're going to expropriate this at some point. They're going to have to pay all these landowners. And it takes, you know, a long time to build this stuff. So if you're paying attention to the engineering studies that come out of, you know, the Ministry of Transportation or whatever, you might say, hey, there's a good land speculation opportunity here if they actually pull the trigger on this. And that's the big what if, right? Like, are they going to have enough money to do it? Is there going to be a reason to build this freeway? And at the time, there certainly was, because there was all this huge population growth happening in the region because of the oil and gas boom, right? And so, you know, like a lot of people on the Klondike, which is, you know, part of our cultural heritage and identity in this part of the world, not the people that were going to look for gold got rich. The people that were on there were like selling things to people looking for gold, people selling the shovels and the pickaxes did all right. So you can make money around an oil boom without being involved in the oil boom, right? Like you can sell beds and trucks to the guys in the oil boom and you'll do pretty well if there's an oil boom going on. So what happened here.
In constructing a public road, is eminent domain in Canada such that if the city or the province condemns the land to build a road, that you are obligated to pay market value, or you are obligated to pay whatever value the owner of the land negotiates?
Well, I think, you know, the preference is always not to go to the courts. And so if it can be negotiated through the minister's office, that's always preferable. And, you know, that's the role of an appraiser, right? And so then it comes down to the opinion of usually a couple of appraisers and what their methodologies are and what you're assessing the land as. So, hey, you want to call this farmland? Okay, well, what's the value of a farmland? Well, hey, I actually could have built a bunch of houses and I had zoning permission for a shopping mall here. Now you got to compensate me like it's commercial land, very different. Or they might say, that's a bunch of muskeg. Sorry, you can't even build anything there or farm there. So it's not worth anything. So you get a dollar an acre for that, right? And so the exact mechanism, John, I'm sorry, I don't recall off the top of my head whether it was expropriated through the courts or if it was a deal, but they did okay at the end of it. And they were compensated well enough to turn that bucket of money into a development project, right? They were able to take it from just being land speculators, but to go vertical, right? And it's a different sort of capital that you need to have to build a vertical real estate.
And so they were not just getting money from selling the highway rights, but then they intended to use that access to turn the rest of their land into valuable development land.
They disposed of the properties. And so the development story of West Edmonton Mall, while it was in the area of where this Henday was, it was inside of the Ring Road. And so they had holdings in this west side of Edmonton, which only recently had been made part of Edmonton. Like, Edmonton was so fast growing, it was sort of annexing all these towns. At one point, this was called Jasper Place. And so they'd annexed Jasper Place in the 60s, and in the 70s, it started to develop this neighborhood called Summerlea, right? And sort of each neighborhood was about a quarter section of land. That was a nice, convenient unit of geography for neighborhoods. It was already laid out that way. A lot of the roads were already in that alignment. Didn't have to make new roads. And so where the actual mall happened was a different asset from where the Henday was, where their expropriation was. But what's important is the money they made from that land speculation is what allowed them to turn it into the mall in nearby.
Go on.
Yes. And so with this mountain of money, with these tens of millions of dollars from this really well-timed and in savvy speculative deal, they were able to convince not just the city of Edmonton, but some investors to say, hey, we're going to build a giant mall. And I'm sure that's not an uncommon or unpopular idea in the 70s. Say, let's build a big mall. They seem to be doing well, right? Like, department stores are a thing. It's sort of the heyday of malls. And what this was more than that. It was something that captured a few unique traits of Edmonton and became an extraordinarily large catchment area. So what I mean by that, John, is people from all around North America, if you're from like way up north in the Yukon, if you're from Saskatchewan, if you're from northern BC, if you're from northern Alberta and you're in the oil and gas business or resource extraction business, your getaway, your weekend getaway, your shopping getaway is to Edmonton in all likelihood, because you're driving there, you're 10, 12 hours on the highway, and you're going to Costco and IKEA because they're the only one within, like, I don't know, 17 hours, any direction, right? So it's sort of civilization. And so you have this incredible force of investment. And what they're saying is, we're not just going to build a mall. We're going to capture all of this pent-up tourist energy, which they can travel, but the farthest nice place they can get is still not that great. So we have to build something totally indoors that has to make it a place that people would say, I'm going to go for a winter getaway to Edmonton. And to do that, you have to have things like a swimming pool with waves and a water park attached to it and a beach, like a simulated beach and a giant atrium and a zoo and a pond with a replica Santa Maria built to scale. You would have a stage with shows. You would have multiple bowling alleys. You would have not one theater. You could like shop your theaters. You would have like three different movie theater branches operating like all across the mall. There'd be the good food court, the bad food court. It's a massive enterprise. It took them probably, they started building in the 70s. They didn't finish until the late 90s. So it was a massive development. It took them decades to complete. And so they took this pile of money and they built this ridiculous thing. And it's this ugly bunker of a building. It's precast concrete, some brick. Mostly looks like a bunker surrounded by a parking lot, multi-story concrete parking lot. But inside it is the most ludicrous place. And I mean ludicrous, like in the academic sense. Like it is kind of crazy. Like at various times it was different flavors of crazy. It's become kind of tame now by modern standards. But at one point, you know, they had a lot of this sort of sculpted, extruded material to look like giant sort of, like characters from Storyland and, you know, Fantasyland was the sort of theme of the theme park. And they had litigious back and forth with Disney over this. They had hotels in the mall. They built workforce housing, you know, about a space the size of the mall to the south of it is just affordable housing that is owned and operated by the same people for people that work in the property.
It's like a space station.
Yeah, like it is like a... a fully functional city unto itself. Like it has, you know, an economy, it has churches, it has a chapel in it. It has neighborhoods and districts within it. So like there's an area that is like the nightlife district. There's an area of it that is the upscale Europa Boulevard where you could go shopping. And it will look as though you were in an arcade, an old arcade in Paris, where you've got sort of these beautiful 3 to 6 story buildings, glass roof over top of you. But then you have, you know, Diesel or whatever the trendy brand is. They're not some ancient atelier like you would find in a real European city. And just like on the False Bourbon Street, you would have, you know, bars and places with open mics and comedy clubs and things like this. This isn't just a regular mall. So they took their money and they built this crazy, ludicrous, capitalist monstrosity. That was a pretty cool place to hang out as a teenager, frankly. Was sort of the experience I had with it.
Yeah. So prior to this, what was the main attraction in Edmonton?
The main attraction in Edmonton? Well, you might go check out the old fort.
Right.
So there was the city was historically a fur trading fort by the Hudson's Bay Company. So you might go visit that. There was the Edmonton Eskimos, or now known as the Edmonton Elks, which is a Canadian football team. That would probably, you know, maybe the Oilers were rising around the time of the mall as well. So honestly, not a lot going on here. Things like Klondike Days would be like the big summer fair, and everyone would bring in their animals to the sort of 4-H sort of style State Farm kind of thing. And that was a big part of the culture. I think there's a lot of polka going on, honestly.
Polka.
There's a lot of polka, and there was a lot of, bingo and curling.
Curling. I mean, that is a major attraction, but you can kind of do that anywhere in northern Alberta. And the Klondike is a long, long, long way from Edmonton.
Doesn't stop us from claiming it haphazardly as a part of our identity, because there's literally nothing else for us to grab onto, because it was just such a blank slate of a place. And there was, you know, just so little interest in participating or involving with Indigenous culture, so Western culture at the time. So let's start something new. And the new thing that they came up with here as sort of our expression of culture and capital during our golden era of an oil boom was the mall. And, you know, some cities might get beautiful skyscrapers or Carnegie Mellon institutions. We got the mall during our golden age, and that's our significant institution. Yeah.
It's interesting that Edmonton does not have like a skyline of really big skyscrapers. Like a city of its size. I mean, even Calgary has like a skyline, and Edmonton's skyline seems much more like not concentrated and sort of random. And
yeah, especially when you're walking around there. Like if you've walked around downtown Calgary and downtown Edmonton, like there's a lot more distance between the towers in downtown Edmonton. Calgary has that density. Calgary is that sort of constant or comparison between Edmonton and Calgary. So it's just natural. But they have the corporate culture, right? They've got the oil and gas HQ, whereas Edmonton is the government town. And so any towers downtown for a long time were like utilities or government offices or railways. And then there was also an airport downtown, which limited our skyline height for a long time, John. So don't think too badly of our skyline.
No, that seems kind of dumb to put the airport right downtown. But I understand when the airport was put there, the town was a lot smaller.
Totally.
Calgary has the thing that Denver has, which is that it's a city there because everything got washed up to the mountain, and then the people that couldn't get over the mountain ended up having to stay there and make a city. So it feels like the cascade of people that came across the prairie hit the mountains and they ran out of steam and that they built a town.
It's a reasonable reaction to see the Rockies, though, to be like, you know what, I've come far enough.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't seem like farming up there is going to work as well as farming down here. Well, so was this successful in terms of building out of whole cloth what sounds like a Las Vegas of the North, except without gambling?
There was a casino.
Oh, there was a casino. So it's an ersatz universe built on a grid in the middle of, well, like what everyone else would think of as the middle of nowhere, although you're just to the left of nowhere. was this just for Edmonton teens, or did people actually make plans around this?
Yeah, and I guess, like, how could it possibly just be for Edmonton teens? Like, how could my friends at Jasper Place High School and I be the ones to sustain this billion-dollar enterprise? It doesn't make any sense. We certainly benefited from it, though, right? And so when I was growing up in, like, the 90s, like, I remember we'd go to the mall because we'd go there, like, once a week, like, whether it was, like, just to go to the food court or somebody needed tennis shoes or somebody was at a movie or we were meeting our grandma for ice cream or whatever. It was just like the convenient place where everything was. So you were there all the time. And like without fail, there was a period of time, I would say for like 7 to 12 years, where you would see people from Africa, the Middle East, and like clearly very wealthy people that had flown here to shop at this mall. And you're like, why are they coming here? And it's the same place that I see like my friend's cousin from way up north. He's like some hick with his cowboy boots on. And then you see these, you know, people that have traveled many more flights than I would be willing to travel to this mall to come here and shop. So it did have a global cachet and at a time before the internet. It's so easy to think of or to forget that there was a time before the internet, John, for me at least. But there was that time where if you wanted to shop luxury goods and to see stuff, you had to go to the mall to see it. And there wasn't really good pictures on your phone or on your computer. And there wasn't like 1,000 Louis Vuittons. And there's maybe only a couple of them. And we only recently got a Louis Vuitton in the mall. I should say that was a big deal. There was an international attraction. And like I said earlier, there's that huge catchment area. So you have Edmonton and it's sort of this outpost for this huge northern area, right? And they're all coming to town. And so on occasion, the other thing that you'd see that I remember, and you still see it, is, you know, groups of kids, Mennonite kids, Hutterite kids. I don't know if you have, they're kind of like the Amish of the West, I guess.
Sure, they're in your neighboring states of Montana, North Dakota, and Minnesota.
And so you'd see the kids from the colonies up north and out east would come into town. And certainly everybody from Saskatchewan, like every long weekend, they would all drive over here because we had no sales tax, provincial sales tax. So everything was like 5% cheaper. And so it was this massive draw for hundreds of thousands of people in a what probably is what most people think of as like a tourist destination. And for a province with really great tourist destinations like Jasper and Banff, there's multiple years where Edmonton, West Edmonton Mall is the number one draw in the province.
Wow. Competing
the likes of Banff. So there.
Well, so the number of opportunities that I have here in Seattle to sport any kind of Louis Vuitton clothes is fairly limited by the fact that that here in Seattle, there is a sort of half zip or a quarter zip sweater culture, and that people would wear to a wedding. They would wear it to the boardroom. They'd be buried in it, depending on how fine the merino wool was. Sure. I can imagine, having been to Edmonton a couple of times, that to walk around Edmonton with a Louis Vuitton bag would be the same as walking around Edmonton in a prom dress. What portion of the mall was actually full of outfitter type things where you're coming in from the north and you just want to buy Hudson Bay blankets and gold pans and, you know, like bunny boots?
That's a great question. And the mall, most of the real estate was taken down by big department stores, right? And sort of the history of Edmonton starts in some ways with Hudson's Bay Company, and it continues with Hudson's Bay Company in the mall. Like, those were their biggest tenants. And when they stopped paying their bill during the pandemic, that was a big problem for the company that owned the mall, right? And so, yeah, the big stores there were like Sears, Zellers, which was sort of Canadian discount department store, and the Bay. And, you know, you'd park at the Bay because it was a bit nicer because the stores around the Bay were kind of nicer than the stores around Sears because they're a little like dotted. And I'm sure that's exactly how the rent stacked up too, right? So there's definitely like different flavors to it, but yeah, it was not just luxury. Like, that was like one small corner of the mall.
Yeah,
like, there was like, they devoted like 1/16th of it, like, to the luxury stuff because it was such a big place they could. But on the whole, it was like massive, the biggest McDonald's you've ever seen, like the biggest, craziest arcade, like, to my mind, I'd ever encountered in nor ever will in all likelihood. Like, sort of imagine that zenith of 80s arcade culture, right? And they built like multi-story ones in there. It was a really well-designed machine to take money from people, right? And so you could stay there at a hotel theme room. Each sort of floor of the hotel, of the Fantasyland Hotel, had like, you could, it was like the island themes, the Roman theme, the sort of 50s drive-in theme, and sort of increasingly greasy and gross themes that you wouldn't want to hang out in. But like hot tubs and stripper poles, I'm sure are amenities available to you in these places. But there's, like I said, there's a chapel. You could get married at the mall. You could go to the water park. It was a really well-designed machine to extract money from you. And so if you were trucking in from, let's see, Prince George. Let's say we're driving in from Prince George.
Okay.
Way out north in the interior BC, takes you 13 hours to come in. You and your kids are coming. You maybe you're driving your big dually truck. You have a trailer. You're loaded up. You're going to buy mattresses potentially at the mall because it's cheaper to do it in Alberta. You're going to get all your kids' clothes for the school year. And then you're going to have like all the fun at the mall too. You're going to go play slots. You're going to go to the water park. You're going to get wasted on Bourbon Street. Yeah. And you're going to do all this in Alberta without having to, you know, get on a plane and fly somewhere.
So one thing to think about when you are, when you're managing a long, hot summer like this one has been, is how do you keep looking groovy? I don't mean just groovy. I mean fashionable, stylish. Even in the desolate dog days of summer, you should still look good because, as many longtime listeners of Omnibus know, I'm a great advocate of men in particular elevating their style a little bit above just wearing t-shirts that have wolves howling at the moon or sports jerseys or cargo shorts and flip-flops or Crocs. And I'm not calling anybody out. If you're sitting in your car right now in Crocs and a shirt with a sports team howling at the moon on it, I love you. I love you and I love your style. But you could kick it up a notch. And a great way to do that in summer is the fabric linen. You know, linen is a sophisticated fabric. It communicates a very European feel. And a lot of people kind of don't understand exactly how to incorporate linen. Linen tends to be, you know, it's more breathable, it's looser tailoring, but you could recognize linen across the room. I mean, in a way, it is the quintessential summertime fabric. And I am fortunate enough to be able to recommend Quince, Q-U-I-N-C-E, Quince. They're doing an incredible job with their linen line of, you know, direct-to-consumer men's fashion. It's very affordable, but the level of quality is really high. They use 100% European linen. They're making pants and shirts, the whole t-shirts, like the whole... every component of a well-dressed man's wardrobe. And it really is, you can see as soon as you look at it, as soon as you go on quince.com and start checking out, and Quince has stuff for women, it has stuff for the home, like the whole website is full of kind of enviable, covetable stuff. And it's all like surprisingly affordable given the level of quality it is. This is the marvelous thing about being able to buy things on the internet, right? It's 50 to 80% less than similar brands, levels of quality and workmanship of other companies with, you know, brand names that they spend millions marketing, right? And the other thing about Quince is they are very conscious of the factories that produce their clothing being ethical and having, you know, good relationships with their workers. So what you're paying for is just the good stuff, and not the marketing, not the storefronts and so on. You know, Quince has stuff for the shoulder seasons, lightweight cotton sweaters, stuff that you're going to want in September. And that's always the toughest time for men. It's still too warm to wear a jacket, but just a little chilly in the evening. Anyway, I think Quince is hot stuff. And if you're looking to just even get one statement piece, this would be a great place to start. So go to quince.com/omnibus. You'll get free shipping on your order, 365-day return policy, which is kind of insane. It's now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/omnibus. Free shipping, 365-day returns, quince.com/omnibus. I can only imagine that when the January wind is howling down and the snow is just moving sideways and you can't see your hand in front of your face, that walking into the what I can only imagine is through the first layer of doors, and then you're in that anteroom that every place in the north has, where you're just meant to stand there for a second and overcome the shock, and you're kind of partially warm, and then through that next set of doors into this, you know, and you shake off your coat and you unzip your thing and you take your hat off, and then you walk through that next layer of doors and you're in Babylon.
Basically.
I mean, that must have been a very intense, particularly for the people that lived in a pre-Babylon world, and then all of a sudden this Babylon arrived in the least likely place to build like an enormous thing like this. So that must have been, it must have reverberated across the whole territory.
I heard it just the other day. You know, I was there, I did my annual trek to the mall despite living so close to it. I hardly ever go there anymore. And so I had a good reason to go there. I wanted to go get some shorts for a trip. And I heard somebody remark, whoa, look at this. As they walked into the mall, like it was, they were like, holy crap. They had that sort of experience of, look at this experience. Like it was the same experience you might have walking around, I don't know, like when you go to Times Square or when you check out Pike's Market for the first time, you're like, whoa, look at this. This is cool. This is the thing. I'm seeing the thing. I'm having that experience that I'm seeing the thing. And maybe you don't know what that thing is because it's a placeless hallway in a mall, but it's giving you that impact. It's not just like any other placeless hallway in a mall. They put the effort into making it have the artifice of looking like an old European city, right? And while the outside is totally devoid of creativity, the inside is a highly creative space, right? And so those, that sense of arrival is really impactful in the winter, in the dry winter. So yeah. Alaskan winters, are they dry? Like how much is Alaskan winter mediated by the coast?
In different parts of Alaska, the winter can be incredibly dry. But in Anchorage, we're just right on the water. So it's a kind of, it's not Pacific Northwest layer level of damp, because it is Alaska, right? It's cold, and so things do evaporate. You know, it can be crispy and dry. But like in Fairbanks, I mean, it's the kind of cold where vodka turns to paste.
Right.
You know, where you throw something up in the air and it just freezes and just hangs there. So I've been in Edmonton like universe, but it is like the moon.
Your nostril hair freezes, right?
Yeah,
and it's a unique experience that you can only get in a very cold place. And so to go from that very cold, dry place to go into the mall, which at some time had a great deal of humidity because it had all these fountains, amazing fountains throughout it. And malls don't, you don't see them as much anymore. And I was wondering why. And so when I was preparing for this show, I was trying to figure out why we don't have fountains in malls anymore. Not just this mall, but malls in general. And it's the humidity demanded it. So you wanted your building space to be humid, and you didn't have the technology in your ventilation system otherwise to keep your space humid other than just having puddles everywhere. So we'll call them fountains. We'll make them decorative. And then we can achieve humidity. But now modern buildings have more sophisticated ventilation systems. And so there's less of a demand or a need for fountains, but it's a great loss to the fun of what a mall is. And so in West Edmonton Mall, what they had were these leaping fountains in the food court. I've seen these probably in Vegas where it's like the little jet of water where sort of jump from lake to lake, right?
Yeah.
But they had those like, I don't know, probably a kilometer worth of them, like navigate like through the mall, winding around. You could watch them just go and go. And so to come in from this heat and to see liquid water moving around and to feel that warmth, that blast of humidity, that warm air, it was really nice. It's a really nice microclimate. It's a really positive place. And I think, you know, I haven't got into as much of the attacking orthodoxy of urban planning as I wanted to in this show, John, but I will a little bit here. But there's a lot of negativity around sort of private enclosed spaces in cities, and that they are sort of the detriment of the public realm. In a really cold city like Edmonton, it's nice to have a giant mall like this. I don't know if I would trade it for having a more vibrant Main Street, because I'm not going to go surfing in a vibrant Main Street. I'm not going to go have that. Whoa. Because it's still going to be cold in Edmonton and my nostril hair is going to be freezing outside. So,
well, one of the urban planning fads of the 70s and 80s in towns like Minneapolis or St. Paul or Spokane even was to build overpasses so that you could stay, you could go from building to building to building and never go outside. Anchorage had a mall like that where they, you know, they built overpasses between different buildings. And then the criticism was that those overpass towns lost any sidewalk life because everybody's just basically in a mall. It's just one or two stories up.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's true, but why can't the ground floor compete, you know? What's like, aren't there a lot of good reasons to be on the ground floor? Like people watching, there's other forces at play there, right? Like, a big part of why these spaces are popular and successful is because they're more regulated, more controlled, right? And, that's part of the controversy, right? Is they're not democratic. They're not public. They're not truly public. Like, so much of our commercial life in Edmonton happens in the mall, but it's not our town square. It's not, you're not going to see, you know, street preacher in the mall.
Or a protest
or somebody, you know, doing something deeply antisocial that would cause other people not want to be around there, which is what you see in a lot of urban cores these days, right?
When you talk about it being a creative space, I often think about these planned kind of communities, and a lot of the idea is absolutely to keep degeneracy out, or to keep the unpredictable or the antisocial out. But there's also a very creative thing in cities that comes from chaos or the dark corners of a city. That's sort of where, I mean, you can't have a city that's completely neutered of dangerous elements. Were there places in the mall where you as a kid were afraid to go? Were there corners of the mall that were like, no, thank you?
Totally. Absolutely. The back layers of the arcade, you know, where the Dance Dance Revolution. Some kids hanging out over there with their really big baggy jeans and they're like 4-liter jugs of water. And you're like, what's in there? It's not water. Yeah. But there was like, I remember my dad saying to me at one point when I was a teenager, he's saying, I really hope you don't grow up to be one of those kids that hangs out in the mall. Like, it was like the worst thing that could happen in his mind. It's like, well, dude, like you live within like walking distance or driving distance of this building. So poor choice. And I go to high school next to it. There was definitely seedy elements of the mall. It was such a, being that we were an egalitarian Canadian frontier city, everyone shopped there, people of all classes. And so you had a great mixing of people. And there would be some adventure on occasion. And there's definitely like, stories of the mall rats. I'm certain you could live in that building. Like,
and no one would notice. You could just like go from...
I'm sure if you were inspired enough. It's probably got harder over time, but...
Well, I see looking at my map here that Jasper Place High School is really close to the West Edmonton Mall. Was it a thing that you went like after school?
Or even at lunch hour. We would walk over there for lunch. We would go get our poutine and our Slurpees or Donair.
So do you think with all of the hotels, was there, for instance, prostitution at the mall? Was there a red light district?
I don't know if there's ever an official red light district, but let's talk about the seedy underbelly of the mall for sure. Like Bourbon Street on its own, just having a little nightlife district there. And then there was also sort of a secondary nightlife district that built out in the latter phases, which was like a club district, which is basically like big box style spaces, so like big cubes that turned into clubs because they did work out as a retail space or whatever, but they had a cluster of them at some point. But there's maybe three or four clubs, and like you could see decent bands at some of these. I saw Vampire Weekend, I remember. That's probably the last good band I saw at one of these. Like, so there was like decent music venues, but like they had a lot of problems with nightlife, nightlife in the sense of like crime that goes along with like people that have rival groups at these clubs.
No, there was gang violence at the West Edmonton Mall?
Not a lot of gang violence. Most of the violence, I would say, would probably be just sort of incidental violence of stupid people getting together, being violent and drunk. CD Underbelly, certainly a lot of, people in the food court selling drugs. You know, your mom would be like, get away from that guy over there. He's going table to table trying to sell drugs. He's not going to sell the mom and her kid drugs. But anyways, there are certainly elements like that. And as you got older, as a kid who grew up around the mall, like you would want to, they're sort of like, yeah, I've seen the public side of the mall, but I want to see the private side of the mall, right? And so at some point you get a job at the mall. And that's your first exposure to the back rooms of the mall.
Did you get a job at the mall?
Oh, I had so many jobs at the mall, John. I worked at a bookstore, which is a great place to work because you get to pick all the cool books as they come in so nobody else can have them. And then I worked at The Gap for a while. And I worked at a sort of an amusement ride where they played Warren Miller, like 3D Warren Miller.
Yeah. And then they moved the seats around so you felt like you were skiing?
I worked in one of those and it was terrible. But yeah, I worked in the mall and you'd get exposure to the sort of back rooms. You'd get to see the rabbit's warren of corridors and giant rooms for like trucks to drive in to pick up all giant dumpsters. And, you know, you're servicing a massive, many times over Olympic pool, like several times of those. And so you've got all this attenuating infrastructure to go along with that and sort of massive, scary tunnels that like, whoa, like nobody's been down there for like a long time because it's some boiler. And it's like, hope you don't get stuck down there because maybe you'll never be found again. And I remember later in my life, I had an opportunity to work on a project on the mall as an urban planner. And I got to see some of the drawings and see some of the permit work. And it was so interesting to know that it was like, it's one of these mansions, you know, like that the crazy person builds and it keeps going and going and nobody knows where it goes. Like it had been layered upon layered so many times that it had sort of this unknowable state that was difficult to help them navigate regulations, shall I say, because so many things had changed and been built upon over time and systems are so complicated that there's rarely an off the shelf sort of solution to their issues. They for sure have fail safes. Like they have emergency protocols that they go through. You know, you'll hear now and then, oh, the SWAT team is doing an exercise at the mall or whatever's going on because it's, it's that kind of place, right? It's got its own police force. To loop back to that story about the clubs, there's one crossover that sort of happened for about 7-8 years there where they had what they called Rock and Ride at the mall, which was basically they put on a rave in the amusement park for underage kids. And you asked if there was a CD Underbelly at the mall. I would say it was probably at Rock and Ride. It was probably the seediest of underbellies, I would imagine. An all-ages rave at an amusement park. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that does sound like something I would not encourage my kid. Well, so here's the West Edmonton Mall. It has become this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. When we think of a plains state or a prairie state mega mall that became a phenomenon, we think of the Mall of America in Minnesota. Did the Mall of America take its inspiration from the West Edmonton Mall?
Same guys, same architect.
Same guys, really?
I'm almost sure it's the same architect too, John.
Well, so in a lot of the rest of the world, like I just went back to Anchorage, and Anchorage used to be very much a mall culture. There was the Northway Mall, there was the University Mall, there was Diamond Center, there was the Downtown Mall, there was the Sears Mall. And those are just the malls that aren't big plazas. Those were the malls that you would actually go as a destination to the mall. And all of those malls are suffering now. Anchorage is no less cold. Anchorage is no less in need of common spaces for people to go walking and do stuff. But the malls are all just like really on the rocks. Not, I don't think, just because of Amazon, but because of some other reason that it's just these common, these town squares mega squares don't have the appeal. Is the West Edmonton Mall still thriving?
It seems to be doing very well for itself. You know, they continue to have sort of these massive retailers go under every so often, whether it's the Bay or Sears, but they take it in stride and continue to develop. There's never been a point at which you'd walk through that mall and think, this is a dead mall. And there's plenty of dead malls in Edmonton to compare it with. So no, it seemed to persist and overcome that that decline. You know, I think to your point about, you know, the mall's been replaced by the virtual space as well, right? Like as far as like a venue for youth culture, like if that's what a mall was, you know, there's yet sort of like consumption of goods in the space there. And then you're displaying it and wearing it and showing it off to everyone. Well, that just happens on the internet now. Your goodies, you buy them and you show them off. And so there's less of a social imperative even, or like a created social imperative for it. That consumer culture happens elsewhere now, I think. Because it's a machine to take out money, right? And so that's all real estate is. It's like, can this machine take money from whatever's in it? And young people aren't spending it there. So.
Did you say that the Hudson Bay Company is out of business?
Yeah.
I thought the Hudson Bay Company was 40% of the economy of Canada.
At one point, it surely was. But yeah, no, they're gone now.
Oh, that's terrible.
They got bought by private equity and now they're like nothing. They're just got sold for parts. They were auctioning off like you could buy their like furniture and like corporate art stuff.
I'm so mad at that. Well, and so does the mall remain a template? Because if you go to Las Vegas now, all of the casinos feel like malls. You know, the Venetian has canals that you can ride in canal boats and it goes forever. You know, you walk around and you're like, this mall can't possibly keep going. And it's just one of a dozen casino malls that are kind of, a lot of them, connected by tunnels. But I don't think Las Vegas would ever want to call itself the largest mall in North America.
No, but it feels super familiar. Like the first time I was in Vegas, I was like, whoa, okay, this is just like more mall. Like it's just like more of that same expression of money. And like I said, it's money expressed through real estate in a way that's designed to take money back as much as it can. And it makes it, as you know, an interesting place. They want it to be sticky. That's what they call it. Is it a sticky place? Is it a place that you want to spend time in? So you watch the fountains, you hang out, watch the fountains. Next thing you know, you're buying some ice cream over there because you spent time watching the fountains. You smell the ice cream, chalk down all. So yeah, it's a template and it was well tested and established in the 70s and 80s and early 90s here. And what you see elsewhere is, yeah, the continuation of that. And they continue to refine it. And you see it, like there's a Chinatown now. Like you were talking about in an earlier part of our discussion, like there's a designated Chinatown and like there's a big grocer there. But there's a few other attenuating stores that go along with it. It's not just that one grocer that like, sort of has its own functional space. So yeah, like what they've really done is they've colonized the city. They've said, Edmonton, you had all this potential for a Chinatown, for a club scene, for a nightlife district. We're just going to colonize all those ideas and put them here. We're going to take them. And that's kind of what Vegas does. It's inevitable. The mall is inevitable. And I think that's the key to all of this, is that it's going to express itself one way or another. And, you know, while the market may have demanded, you know, 7-8 malls in a town the size of Anchorage at one point, it doesn't demand that now. And it's just, there's more competition for the dollars, right? So that virtual space, that hyper reality in the malls are closer than people think. Like they're physical. One's the physical expression of the other, right? Which is somebody's designed a system to put you in a state where you feel very comfortable separating yourself from your money. And so they can put you in that state online through dark algorithms, or they can put you in that state through pleasant architecture that happens to navigate you past just the right mix of stores that you'll feel like, yeah, I'm in the mindset of spending money.
And that concludes West Edmonton Mall, entry 1422.JO0502. Certificate number 43923 in the omnibus. Now, longtime listeners, and even if this is your first episode of the Omnibus Project, you should know that Adam and I mostly agree that social media and online spaces are no substitute for gathering together in the dark corners of your local mall or really your local Space Needle or wherever it is that other people are congregating. We discourage you from using social media, but if you insist, if you are someone who is listening to this show and looking at their phone and you need the experience of social media, then you can find future links to talk about this show and all our other shows. Wherever you Google the words Futureling, it will turn up social media spaces on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, elsewhere. You can find us on YouTube, where you can see our discussion. Adam is in a blurred background super state, and I'm sitting in front of a bunch of analog expressions of my inner life. You can see that on youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. You can email us here at The Omnibus Project at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can, as Adam did, submit a show or a show suggestion to omnibusproject.com/submit. How long ago did you submit West Edmonton Mall?
Last October. It was almost a year.
Really early on in the queue. Well, have you been enjoying Omnibus 2.0?
I have been. I really enjoy it. It's not the same, but it's good.
Good. Good. I'm glad. That should be our motto. Not the same, but good. You can send mail to the Omnibus Project, and we will open it during our monthly addenda show that's available on Patreon, and that mail goes to The Omnibus Project, 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And finally, our show is listener-supported. Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can hear with a nominal monthly contribution, you can watch a half-hour episode where Adam and I talk about urban planning and his life in Edmonton. And that is true of every 2.0 episode. We have little discussions that give greater context. Of course, you could listen to this episode without that context, but it's marvelous context. Wouldn't you agree? Didn't we have a nice talk?
I almost enjoyed it better. Frankly, I think people would be well advised. Go and subscribe.
So patreon.com/omnibusproject and join up. Tons of reasons that are not just supporting the show, but that is also maybe the greatest reason.
Future links from our vantage point in your distant past. We have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in The Omnibus.